Hey, I'm Terry Foy.
And I'm Nick Osello. Welcome to the tailgate.
Thank you for coming back to the Tailgate Podcast. I am Terry Foy, joined once again by Nick Osello, and I am not exaggerating when I say that I have never been as excited to record a podcast as I am to record this one right now. Nick, thank you so much for joining me. How are you doing?
First off, I can't believe you just keep letting me come back and spew nonsense on a weekly basis. Thank you very much for the opportunity. I feel like I'm in for a doozy of an episode. Before we get into lacrosse, you've had a pretty unbelievable and amazing weekend. Surmised in a tweet that you mentioned, it almost reminded you why you fell in love with the game in the first place. Before we break down college lacrosse and the happenings, I don't think there were any relevant games this weekend, personally speaking. Can you give us some insight into what you were up to?
Yeah, no question. Well, so it actually started on Friday when I went to a high school game. I went to McDonough versus Noble and Grinnell, which is as hoity-toity as it sounds, but it was great. Got an opportunity to see a bunch of friends and some really high-level high school action. So, you know, the weather was terrible. It was definitely like one of those early March moments when you're just like, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it was like on turf and all that other stuff. But still, it had like the vibe, right, of high school lacrosse in terrible weather, but it was really high level, so it was awesome. But no, so I was asked in the fall to do something that was pretty unique for me and not for the world. I was asked to deliver the keynote address at the 53rd anniversary celebration of the West Virginia men's club lacrosse team. And the way that
that's
the event
awesome.
Was structured,
that's
they were
so sick.
Yeah, so the event was retiring the jersey of Jeff Dreisbach, who was the guy who founded the club and then ended up coaching it for multiple decades, and then started, I think, 11 teams over the course of his prolific playing and coaching tenure. Just an incredible ambassador and advocate for the game, who has really like bolstered it on the frontier, the literal frontier. And I'm just going to kind of give the first like two and last 2 minutes of my speech, because it's essentially the whole point of this, why this extravaganza was so cool and so invigorating. So I know why I was asked. Jim Mills is a cardiologist who is the faculty advisor for the club, and he's in his 10th year of doing it. And he has done tremendous work to elevate the program and get it to a position where they could have an event with 200 people in a fancy hotel in Morgantown, West Virginia. And I had developed a line of communication with him through the highest form of communication in all of humanity, which is Twitter direct messages. And he asked me to do it. And when he introduced me, he said he thought that asking was a long shot. Little did he know that if you want me to show up anywhere, just ask me to talk about lacrosse in front of a crowd of people and I will be there. Toot sweet. So
that's how they get you. Okay. Yes. Good to know.
Yeah. Audience, take note. So I said yes. And then wondered, why am I doing this? Like, I have no relationship with the state or University of West Virginia. I am not really a club lacrosse guy. I was earlier in my career, but I'm like almost 10 years removed from really being dialed into the MCLA. I'm not like going to inspire anybody because I've never coached, especially a room full of players and coaches. And I'm not a comedian, so I'm not going to make anybody laugh. So I kind of asked him, like, why did you ask me? And he said, well, because I can't get John Paul, which I took as a compliment. And then he was like, don't worry about it. You're in a room full of lacrosse people. They love lacrosse. So I was like, all right, cool. That put me at ease. I was like, all right, I'm talking to a room full of lacrosse people all across. That's the thing I'm best at in the world. So, you know, I kind of had my whole thing and whatever. I'm not going to talk to you about the middle of my speech, but so the way that the weekend was structured was there was a high school game featuring Preston, which is like the easternmost county of the panhandle that, when you're going into Western Maryland, like that's the last county you drive through. And Jeff Dreisbach's nickname is Redbeard. Redbeard started the program at Preston. It's very rural and it's not thriving. But they scheduled a game, at the place where, the alumni game was going to be following against a local Morgantown high school. So that started at noon, and my goal was to get there. Well, ran into car trouble on the way out because I'm such a attentive car maintainer, and I missed the high school game. But I got there in the middle of the alumni game, and like the first thing I saw was a guy score a goal. And then run off the field because he was a midi and he was like his shift was over or whatever. And then forget that he had or remember that he had put his beer on the back of the net. So he ran back to get it. And then the referee, who was not wearing shoes, like chastised him for not getting off the field faster. And I immediately sent those things to you, those observations. And then apparently this is something that West Virginia is known for. I didn't know it, but they built like their own essentially monorail system in the like 70s, and it's called the Personal Rapid Transit, the PRT, and they're like these little shuttles that are on train tracks that you essentially like swipe your student ID and it comes and picks you up. So there's no like schedule or anything like that. It's legitimately like on demand. It takes you all over town. It's incredible. It is legitimately like the monorail episode of The Simpsons. So those like little cute little trains are running like behind the field. And I'm like, this is incredible. So I sent you a video of that and you're like, are you in heaven? Well, Nick, I responded in a way that you appreciated, and I incorporated it into my speech, into the kicker, as a matter of fact, of my speech. And at this point, like I knew it was going pretty well. But when I said, well, first of all, I told them about you, and many of them are your reputation preceded you, and the ones who didn't appreciated that
Bummer.
I share a microphone weekly with some idiot who played lacrosse and likes to drink beer, and in that way very much appeals to the West Virginia Club lacrosse team. And I said, so Nick asked if I was in heaven, and I said, almost. And there was a round of laughs, but then even better than that, there was like this. I can't even understand how you would be like a WV person and that wouldn't immediately click to you. So that's probably what the distinction was in the crowd, right? Like half of them were like alums and half of them were like parents of the current players. So like, but there was like this slow build of the understanding of the pun. And I just was like, I'm not ready to end this speech, but I'm not going to be able to end it any better than that. So thank you. I'm out. And I just walked off. It was so validating, so vindicating, and so perfect. And to your point about why it like ignited the flame, and that is kind of also a pun because they hosted Liberty on Sunday, so the day
Boo.
following the event, and today as we record exactly, which I definitely got both some laughs and some cheers by some derisive jokes at Liberty's expense. Who had just been ranked number one in the MCLA poll last week. Liberty is one of the best organized and best resourced, one of the most talented clubs in MCLA Division One. I don't want to say very many more nice things about them because for whatever reason you decided that they are your villain and I want to play into that character. That being said, they're very good. They had just won and or I'm sorry, they had just become number one. They won on Saturday night against Pitt and they were coming to town on Sunday. Their nickname is the Flames, so that's why it's a pun because it reignited this whole experience, just reignited like why we all fall in love with lacrosse, right? Like obviously there's a certain percentage of people who, are born in places where it's the most important sport and there's incredible infrastructure and stuff like that. You and I did not. We were not born into that, right? Like we came
We
from the part of the
you wouldn't
country
allow it for a
where like
second, would
white
you?
socks and black cleats. Oh my God, no way. No way. So like yeah, we were from the parts of the country where Liberty MCLA players looked down on us for like
Yeah,
our lacrosse
unbelievable.
pedigree.
Yeah.
But the point is that, it was people that had this incredible shared passion. They weren't getting anything out of the experience, right? It was satisfying their passion and it was incredible because we're essentially at the halfway point, right? Like, I'm not going to sit here and tell you that covering college lacrosse is a slog. It is not. It's awesome. It's one of the best jobs that anybody could have. It's one of the best jobs in the world. But at the same time, it is long, right? It is 4 months and it is a fast pace and you can't fall behind and whatever. So the point is that if you have an opportunity in the middle of it to essentially pull yourself back and remind yourself why you do it, it is valuable, especially when you're doing what I was doing, which was having, you know, Army Loyola on the iPad as I'm driving 3.5 hours from Baltimore to Morgantown, and then having Penn Cornell in the replay of Army or Notre Dame, Virginia. Oh, wait, did that game happen? On the iPad on the way home. You know what I mean? So it's like, you got to find ways to like make it happen. And when you can sandwich that around like this incredible experience, it was really tremendous. So they sent me home with a keepsake. You are not a goalie, so you don't appreciate that number 37 is like the universal goalie number.
Look,
so I got
a, he's showing me the perfect Mountaineers jersey.
Correct. So that will find a place of prominence in the inside of the Cross office. But you know what, Nick? They weren't done.
What's that? You're
they wanted
kidding.
To make sure that you had your own Mountaineers jersey.
Oh my God, Harry, that just pulls at my heartstrings. That tickles me in such a way that not many things can. I'm looking at a West Virginia Mountaineers number 20, the iconic jersey. I remember watching Tavon Austin highlights growing up, and I remember watching everybody go to West Virginia. I love their so there were a couple times, and let me just get this anecdote out of the way, and then we can actually start covering college lacrosse. But you said it best very briefly. You can achieve the number one thing that anybody wants to do playing lacrosse, which whether that's, you know, you end up going Division I, whether that's you end up playing professional, you know, I kind of got to check off a lot of boxes that not many people get to do. However, if you attach your sense of self-worth and your personality to the achievements on the field, shit gets pretty dark when that ability to play on the field is taken away. That happens to everybody. I don't care who you are. At some point, you have to give it up and retire. And when I retired from the PLL, when my playing days were over, it actually coincided with a very not fun time in my life where I was, directionless, didn't know what I was going to do. And I ended up packing up my shit in a car and going on an aimless road trip across the country, in which the only way I was supporting myself, I believe at this time my credit card debt was higher than my savings account, which is not a place you want to be in, especially when you go to a good university and you kind of had a lot of things going for you in life. You don't want to be the guy that blows that, and I was the guy that blew it. And so I hit the road, and I literally just would call someone in the lacrosse community that I found online the week before I was showing up in their community and just saying, hey, man, I'm going to be in town. I have a wealth of lacrosse knowledge. I don't have much else going for me right now. Any way I could make a couple $100 to pay for gas and food on my way to the next wherever the hell I'm going. And through that entire loop that took me from Idaho to California to Nevada to Iowa to Texas to Alabama to Nashville, all the way up to visiting TD in Rochester, back through Cincinnati, Ohio, down through Dallas, out to Colorado again, you just realize that it is so much more important than on-field achievements in 100 different ways. And the simple fact that lacrosse is the Trojan horse of great examples of humanity, I feel like you got to experience at the height, which can be shown in a lot of different ways, but my personal favorite way of exemplifying the best that humanity has to offer is a midfielder forgetting his beer on the back of a lacrosse net and a shoeless ref yelling at him. So Virginia, now that I'm not worried about my on-field accomplishments, never will be, I'm much more worried about having a beer and surrounding myself with good people. I'm going to come out there and I'm going to give a speech that's 10 times better than Terry's just to show him how to do it. So fantastic start to the weekend, or fantastic weekend to start to the episode. Thank you for sharing, Terry.
Did anything else happen this weekend?
No, that's it. Listen, it was a great episode. We'll see you next weekend.
It was a great podcast. So, it was a short episode, guys. Sorry. We'll get on with it. hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, we'll get through this. So Notre Dame, Virginia, number one versus number three, Arlotta. Notre Dame was offering free Dave's Hot Chicken, which I think was a beautiful little cherry on top. What a performance by Virginia. They jumped out to an early lead that Notre Dame miraculously came back from, tied it up. But ultimately, it was this duo of Schellenberger and Dixon. Schellenberger with 2 and 5, Xander Dixon with 6 goals on the day and an assist to boot. Meanwhile, Pat Kavanaugh went 2 and 2. Chris Kavanaugh, 2 and 0. Jake Taylor had a great behind the back. And before I talk about how great it was when the football team showed up and honestly contributed to one of the cooler moments, fan moments I can remember in college lacrosse, I thought it was a game that just was almost personified by Virginia exploiting and winning some individual matchups. I don't think it was anything crazy schematic. I don't think it was anything that isn't going to be able to be, you know, I would argue that that's not many people can replicate that because Notre Dame had not seen an attack unit like Virginia's, particularly from X and using picks. It just seemed like they caught Notre Dame with their pants around their ankles, miscommunicating on picks, getting hung up at X, making sure that they were initiating in ways that Notre Dame might not have been comfortable with. And that, to me, was the story of the day. Combine that with Notre Dame's football team showing up right as that comeback was happening, the football team going nuts on the side of the hill, a packed, shitty, snowy, rainy, overcast day in South Bend, electric atmosphere. And honestly, I feel like that bright spot for Notre Dame of coming back and tying the game was, one of the most enjoyable times I've had watching lacrosse, just because to see the football team on there, to see Arlotta at peak capacity, and to have the excitement of that game that delivered was fantastic. But I'm curious what your thoughts are.
So again, I was driving from, basically 11 a.m. on Saturday through 2:30. So, and I was locked in on Loyal Army. It was like the game that I was assigned. Kevin Brown was handling Notre Dame, Virginia. So I didn't really know anything about the game flow other than the final score up through when I started basically watching the replay back on my ride home. And when I say watch, what I mean is that I have like the iPad sitting on the driver or the passenger seat. I have like the audio going through the like speakers of the whatever. And I like glance over when something important happens in an effort to not, drive off the side of the road. So I was shocked. I thought that basically Notre Dame fell behind. Well, so it was 1-1 or 1-0 Notre Dame and then 1-1. And then they were trailing 5-1. I just assumed that they trailed the entire way because the reaction that I had seen on Twitter and the people that had texted me and everything else, I mean, it was really down. It was really negative. Like they had gotten totally destroyed. And the fact that they basically lost this game twice is kind of the way that I interpret it. Meant that they didn't win the game once, but they brought it back to neutral. And that, I agree with you, is something that a positive can be taken away from. I also agree with you that for me, this game came way more down to playmaking than it did tactics and game flow, even than it did matchups. Like, I'm going to push back a little bit on that notion. Like, I'm not saying that Virginia didn't exploit certain matchups, but even like Connor Schellenberger, like for me, the emblematic play of the game for him, and this was way more about a playmaking moment than it was a matchup moment, was when he came up with that ground ball after the scrum at midfield. And then, kind of Carr talked about how he was a midfielder as a freshman and an All-American midfielder. And so he's used to playing above the cage. And so the fact that he was able to look off a defender and find Xander Dixon for, I think it was his fourth of the day and an easy goal. Like, to me, that's not a matchup based production. That's a playmaking outcome. And, I'm not saying that there are, I don't know how many times this game gets played and Notre Dame wins. But the way the game flow went means that it was more than zero, right? And, again, I don't know how many games when they're decided by 5 goals, you would typically say the losing team would win in that scenario. But in this one, it was not a garden variety 5-goal loss, which is not to make apologies or excuses for Notre Dame, right? Like, to me, this was a reflection. And I think that this is the point in the year, and we're going to talk about this with a number of other games, where motivation has an undue outcome on the game, because if you have lost like 2 or 3 games in a row, your desperation, your motivation is going to be different than your opponent if they haven't suffered a similar type of series of setbacks. The simple fact is that Virginia was coming off of an overtime loss and Notre Dame hadn't lost yet. So hungry dog runs faster. Virginia was always going to be the hungrier dog. I picked Notre Dame, but that was because I was under the impression that their talent was enough to cover it. I didn't think Notre Dame was going to go undefeated this season. I just thought they were going to win this particular game because of a number of the factors that we're talking about, including that they were at home and including that they were really talented. But the point is that, like, if I'm Notre Dame and I lose this game, it's not like I'm going back to the drawing board in the same way that Virginia didn't go back to the drawing board after they lost to Maryland. Right now, understandably, there's a difference between an overtime loss versus a 5-goal loss. But at the same time, like, there are a number of pipes that were hit. There are a number of loose balls that go the other way. And, there is a meaningful number of plays where if you play with the edge of the team that is more desperate, those goals spin the opposite direction. So, it's not incredibly high level analysis, but it was my takeaway from this game. I had people that were basically jumping off the bandwagon. I'm like, why? Like, if it is a tier of Maryland, Virginia, and Notre Dame, which I don't believe that it is, but if it is, you have beaten one of those teams and you just lost to the other one, and you're going to get to play them again as the desperate one, as the hungrier dog. Like, you're going to be fine.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. I think given Virginia is notoriously the we have a stable of horses and athletes and we thrive in the almost like exactly what you just said, exemplified by that Schellenberger, to give some analysis that nobody else can. And I don't know if this is still relevant as much as it was when I was playing. Anytime we got ranked
Are you
number
going to give
one.
us the analysis of a Notre Dame player who's thrown a punch in a game? Because this was not made very much of, but did Pat Kavanaugh punch Grayson Saladay with like 32 seconds left in the game? Because
No, that
it looked
no,
like maybe
he
he
would never
did.
do that. Well, listen,
Notre Dame guys just don't punch
don't be.
players. They just don't punch people in lacrosse games.
They just no. Punches are meant to be thrown at 2 a.m. outside of a bar, certainly not on a lacrosse field, and I would never do either one of those things. The analysis I was going to give, however, is whether or not Kevin Corrigan is the same coach that he was when I was there. I would say that he hasn't changed a whole lot, and one of the worst weeks of practice was any time we were ranked number one. Anytime we were ranked number one, guess what? I'm a junior on the team, coach. I'm not a member of the media. I'm not ranking people. I'm just a humble, all-American former high school quarterback, that didn't fumble any onside kicks. I'm not the one ranking these teams. But he acted as though everybody on our team said, we're done, guys, season's done. We're number one. Let's pack it up and let's go. And those weeks of practices were always the worst. We would be praying for number two, number three. And when inevitably we would see number one, we're like, all right, we're going to lose this game to St. John's. We're going to lose this game to Drexel because our legs are going to be jello. Because, every college coach is a lunatic. I don't care which one it is. And when we're number one, Coach Corrigan's favorite flavor of lunatic was, you guys think you're so good. You guys are reading too many articles about yourselves. Why don't you get on the end line? And we're like, I swear, I don't think we're that good, coach. So I would like to bring that into attention as a potential factor in a game in which you need the last second kick to get a ground ball scrum. You need to kind of have a bit of a tighter, you need to empty the clip on everything that you have. And if your clip isn't as full as Virginia's might have been, they came out number one and there were some group chats rumblings of like, we're going to lose because it's going to be a tough week of practice. So that's just a little bit of insight that you wouldn't get from anybody else.
That's why you come to the Tailgate Podcast, folks. I mean, what else do you want? You got gas and beers in West Virginia and learning about how terrible weeks of practice were when Notre Dame was ranked number one.
Yeah.
You
I
get this
mean,
podcast for free? Are you
almost.
kidding me? Nick, what's your
Yeah. We
Venmo?
honestly should put it. We should just put it on OnlyFans or Patreon, depending on what your flavor is. West Virginia, almost heaven. Notre Dame, when you're number one, almost hell. Anything else you want to touch on this game before we move on?
I don't think we're going to talk about Duke St. Joe's. So let me just quickly say that Duke played their best defensive game of the season against the Hawks. And they, you know, Kenny Brower and Wilson Stevenson really terrorized Levi Anderson. And Duke plays Virginia on Friday, 5 p.m., happy hour lacrosse. You might want to watch it. If you didn't know, Duke has won 20 of the last 22 meetings against the Virginia Cavaliers since 2005. The only two games that they have lost to Virginia have been in the postseason, meaning that they have won 20 consecutive regular season games. And last year, when Duke was on its way to not making the NCAA tournament, they played the number 6 Virginia Cavaliers and beat them 17-8 in Charlottesville. So I don't know what that means as far as like betting is concerned. Presented without comment.
Duke's hot.
Let's move on to game number 2.
Yeah. Duke's hot right now. They're
Duke
the
could be as
that
cold
I wouldn't want to play.
Duke could Say be it. As cold as ByteDance's US IPO, which isn't cold at all. I wanted to include a TikTok
Sick.
Joke, and I was afraid that I was going to like lack the opportunity to do it later in the podcast. I don't know. Whatever. It's cooler than Jerome Powell's seat. I don't know. Like, Duke could be very cold.
Hey, that one works.
Would still
that plays.
Virginia in the regular season.
That plays. I like it. speaking of a bunch of finance stuff. Dartmouth secures their first
Gross.
Ivy League win. And I mean, yeah, this one's interesting. Obviously, Jerry Byrne, Will Corrigan, Harvard staff, good friends of mine, but this one blows my mind. So Dartmouth started off the season hot, but then got, destroyed by North Carolina. So it was always a, how good are they? And in the race to the bottom, how good is Dartmouth? How bad is Harvard having of a year? The final score was 10-9 in overtime. Teddy Malone for Harvard scoring 4, and then Colin McGill scoring 4 for Dartmouth. Nate Davis, Tommy Rogan, and Quinn Moore scoring 2 apiece. Harvard was up. Harvard was up, I believe. What were they up? They were up. Sorry, this is bad.
Well,
bad
they were
notes,
they were in control. For
9-5
the first half for sure.
Yeah, it was everything that, you know, Harvard was looking for. 9-5, not a high scoring game. And then Dartmouth rushes back. And honestly, it's a pretty cool clip. When Dartmouth wins in overtime, it doesn't say a lot about playoff implications, but it says a lot about how excited Dartmouth is as a program. And moving forward, something that they can leverage to get more recruits. It's always surprising when an Ivy League team doesn't have a good lacrosse program, because guess what? A lot of kids probably want to go to Dartmouth for academics. So the question mark around why they've been bad has always been swirling in the back of my head. So seeing that overtime goal go in and seeing the excitement in which they went and mobbed their goalie, seeing them, generally speaking, understanding the impact that that could have on the next decade of their program, this could be a game that Dartmouth identifies as a turning point for their program for years to come. And honestly, I think it's a pretty big red flag for Harvard on what's been certainly not a season that they've wanted to live up to after making the playoffs last year. So a tale of a program on the rise and a tale of a program that is going to need to bounce back in a pretty big way.
Yeah, I mean, you know, tumultuous week for Harvard, coming off of an overtime win over Brown, right? You feel good about that. Obviously, Brown is dealing with their own struggles at the moment in terms of their suspended seniors who will be coming back here in short order. But with respect to Dartmouth, I believe 3 Ivy League opponents schedule midweek games before playing them, right? Which is just everything you need to know about the level of respect that they garner from the teams that should be the most concerned about playing them. Harvard being 1, and they played Boston University on Wednesday or Tuesday. And that was a weird game. They didn't have the amount of energy that you usually see from a Crimson team. But it's not only about Harvard and anything that's going on with the Crimson. It's also about a cresting wave for Dartmouth. And the simple fact is that this has been visible to people who have looked closely at the program for about 3 or 4 years. And, you know, first of all, I want to give credit to Brendan Callahan because he's been the head coach for, I believe, 8 seasons, 9 seasons, somewhere in that neighborhood. He has done tremendous work. I'm going to point to three other factors that are outside of his well, one is his direct control. The other two are a little bit outside of his direct control. And it's not meant to mitigate the impact that he has had on their ascendancy in terms of the quality of team that they are. So the first is that he hired Joe Connor, who is an assistant coach at Bucknell, and I think is a really good coach. He's also a really good recruiter. And I think that, to your point, it was the issue at Dartmouth, I don't think was ever really about talent acquisition. It was about development. And to a lesser degree, I don't even want to say that. It was just about development. And the development was really, you know, infrastructurally hampered into considerable and meaningful ways. The first is their study abroad requirement. Basically, if I understand it correctly, every junior was abroad in the fall of their junior year, right? It had tremendous effects on their continuity, their ability to improve in the offseason, and everything that went along with that. And then the other side of the coin is, I believe they're the northernmost Division I program, which would simply mean that they deal with really bad weather a lot. And until very, very recently, and I'm not sure if this is the first year for it, I think it opened in the summer of like 2022, they have an indoor facility. So those two factors, I don't know if I made that first point clear. They changed their study abroad rules such that now you can, I think, do it in the summer or like you don't have to do it in the fall of your junior year. So as a result, they have this line of continuity and player development that is just clearly manifested. So when, you know, you combine those four factors, continuity from the head coach, the arrival of assistant coach, who I think is really talented, and this change in policy with respect to players being on campus, and then an indoor, the creation of an indoor facility. I mean, it swirls up into something really dramatic. And I think that Dartmouth was so much better last year than they had been the last time that we had seen them. But you just couldn't tell because the Ivy League in aggregate was so good. So as a result, their losing streak that dated back to 2015 was extended another year. I believe it was Matt Kinnear. We did our preseason prediction, said this was going to be the year that Dartmouth's Ivy League losing streak ends. You know, and I don't think he picked a particular game. But again, this is not a surprise to people who have been paying attention. You know, kind of, it is like under the cover of darkness to an extent. So in that respect, I can understand why it would be surprising. But in terms of like Dartmouth is improving and, you know, how far they have to go and how quickly they'll get there, those remain open questions. But, you know, I mean, all the guys that you named, I think their best player is Brandon Venturola. And he was the one who took the shot that was rebounded that led to the overtime game-winning goal. He wasn't in the score sheet, which just suggests a depth of talent and a depth of production that is a reflection of everything that we talked about from the standpoint of recruiting and development. So, you know, buy your Dartmouth stock, hire a Dartmouth, grad to trade it for you, and, you know, you'll see 11% annual returns.
All right, well, two things. One, the University of Vermont would like a word about the northernmost program. You know, do not sleep on my Google abilities while you were talking.
Did you pull up a Google Maps thing and do, like, the...
The first thing I Googled was drive University of Vermont to Dartmouth. University of Vermont's significantly further north.
Okay.
Just a little note.
My New Hampshire geography. I apologize to Kyle. Yeah.
But follow-up question for you. Coming off of that, it seems like there is a big change of Ivy League last year versus this year. Do you think this is not the last win in the Ivy League that Dartmouth takes this year?
Ooh, that's a good question. I mean, let me ask you, put yourself in the mind of a Dartmouth lacrosse player who winning an Ivy League game was the national championship, and then you win it. Mm-hmm. I've said Hungry Dog Runs Faster already on this podcast. I try to limit myself to one usage per podcast.
Mm-hmm.
Can you muster that level of desperation again? Especially if you don't think you're going to win three and qualify for the Ivy League tournament.
Yes, I think that once you get a little taste, you're going to want, you know, you get one bite of a burrito, that's not a full stomach. They want a little double meat, chipotle, with some guac on the side. Yes, they know it's extra. And I'm going to call it right now. I think it happens against Yale. And we're going to talk about that Yale game and the Yale back-to-backs in a couple games from now. But, I mean, I like that the reason I think Dartmouth wanted to get that big weight off their chest is only going to grow into a, hey, so we got that monkey off of our back. Now let's go and terrorize the Ivy Leagues that's been beating us. You know, they have decades of resentment and being at the bottom of the barrel. That doesn't go away in one victory, nor does I think it ever go away for the foreseeable future. So I think that every game they could justify as we've been little brother for too long. We were little brother for our entire childhood. Well, guess what? We just hit puberty. We just got bigger than our older brother. And now we get to do a little comeback season, and it certainly doesn't stop. If anything, I would think that they become more dangerous now knowing, you know, hope's the most dangerous drug. Watch any dystopian teen drama movie. They never want the people to get hope. And now I think, yeah, I recently watched Mockingjay, and I think that
you just You just reminded me that I meant to make a Hunger Games District 12 joke about West Virginia, and I just totally blanked on it. This is the first I've thought of it, and I gave a speech 27 hours ago.
All right, well,
so all you listeners, just go back into your brain and insert that in some sort of dystopian type of way. Like Total Recall, right? Isn't that what we're talking about there with the implanting memories or whatever?
Yeah. So I
you
say they beat Yale, and I say
came out. Don't pretend like you know what I'm talking about. You think Dartmouth beats Yale?
Yeah, I think Dartmouth beats Yale. They get two Ivy League wins. Do you think they get another in conference win before the year's over?
No, I don't.
Wow, hater alert! Guess what? You just made more bulletin board material. Well, moving on, another good game is Maryland-Penn State. I feel like Penn State, we've talked about a couple times as they're really good, they're doing things good, they take a step back versus Marquette. So this was a good kind of where are they? They ended up losing 13-10, and I think two stats that really stick out that kind of tell the tale of the tape here is Maryland held Penn State scoreless for almost a full 30 minutes. I think that was spanning from halfway through the third quarter until darn near the end of the game. Anytime you hold the team scoreless for 30 minutes, that alone, I feel, could tell the tale of the tape. But you combine that with a 70% day at the X, and they were up 8-3 at one point, I believe. Anytime that happens, you know, 30 minutes of scoreless is fantastic. And I think it goes back to... you know, I feel like we bring up these names every week regarding Maryland, where Ajax Epitello and McCarr really just putting the clamps on a Penn State team that has seemed to have firepower coming into this game. So what does it say about Penn State? What does it say about Maryland? You know, a 13-10 end of, you know, final score is certainly closer than I think Maryland fans would have liked after Penn State takes a step back. But... overall, a pretty good tilt for the Big Ten.
Yeah, for sure. I think that it says that basically both teams are what we thought they were. You know, there wasn't a ton that unfolded in this game that changed pre-game expectations. I think that if there's something that was important, it was that Penn State can play at this level. And obviously, as you said, you know, they didn't keep pressure on throughout the game, but they did manage to make runs, particularly in the second quarter. And I think that for this team, they're a weird team. And I've written and spoken about this a few times over the course of the year. They got very old very fast, but they're also still very young. And what that means is that there's a lot they don't know about each other. There's a lot that can be gleaned and gained from film that I think has like kind of compounding effects as the season goes on. It's unfortunate, I suppose, to an extent that Penn State had to open their Big Ten play with Maryland. But at the same time, if you're going to try to reach the highest bar, you might as well try to do it right away and then kind of proceed from there. So I think that if I have two takeaways, it's that Virginia did not struggle to manage success after beating Virginia. I'm sorry, Maryland did not struggle to manage success after beating Virginia. And Penn State is, they're still a step behind Maryland, but they are as good as, they've kind of been ranked throughout the year, being essentially 8-12 after losing to Marquette, which is, I think, where they were in the consensus of most voters.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that we're just so smart and spot on with our analysis that a game that's objectively a good one and objectively important doesn't change any narratives of what you and I have discussed previously. This game didn't move the needle for me much at all, and just was a huh, wow, something went
There were a couple
right.
things.
My
There were a couple.
prediction and what I thought.
There were a couple things I noticed that are worthy of calling out. I thought Zach Whittier played really well. He's a guy that I don't think we've said his name on the podcast previously. He's a really good off-ball cutter from the midfield for Maryland. He got open a bunch of times, scored a couple times, or he scored at least once and was open a couple other times. For Penn State, O'Connor, Ryan O'Connor, I think is his name, number 42, the long stick middie. That kid, man, he just makes so many plays. Jack Posey got crushed in, I believe, the ribs with a shot, and then came back, so that was good to see. I don't know, I was only able to watch the first half, and then I went through and watched the goals in the second half, subsequently. So yeah, I mean, I could go on, but we're 40 minutes in and we've got a lot more games to get to, so let's keep it rolling.
Yeah, no worries. Next game is going to be Hopkins, Michigan. Hopkins takes it 15-11, led by Garrett Degnan, and he had five, by the way, which for those keeping score at home is good. Honestly, an interesting game because it was a neck and neck battle for the first three quarters, and then I believe the Jays outscored the Wolverines 5-1 in the fourth quarter. And something that stood out to me was, it wasn't really anything magnificent that led to that 5-1, winning in that fourth quarter. I feel like the game was summarized by that fourth quarter, and it wasn't a, oh, it was an individual performance by a guy going around the world between the legs. It just happened to be Hopkins relying on some fundamentals, not playing hero ball, and honestly, a step forward in team offense. And three players accounted for 13 of their 15 goals. So that might not be represented by the stat sheet of just how much of kind of a collective team group effort it was offensively, just relying on fundamentals, crisp passes, and taking the great, not the good shot. But credit to Michigan, they kept it close as long as they could and then just let it slip away from them in the fourth. What do you got?
I mean, again, not to talk about how smart we are, but I was talking to John Paul on Saturday morning, who was going to the Michigan Hopkins game, because I wanted his advice on how to address the crowd that he was originally supposed to address on that Saturday night. Because, as I said, he was
Wow.
invited to deliver the original. And so we were talking about the game, and I basically said that I expected it to unfold exactly as it did. I thought it was going to be a close game through the end of the third quarter. And I don't know if it was tied. It was tied 11-11, and I don't know whether that was the end of the third quarter score, if that was with like 3 or 4 minutes left in the third. And then, Hopkins, or maybe it was 10-10. And then Hopkins went on what you said, a 5-1 run or whatever to close the game. And the reason I felt like it was going to happen that way is because that's what we've seen out of the Blue Jays so far this season. And I'm going to try to, I don't know, I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, protect him, because I have no, he won't care. So I texted Pete Milliman this morning and I said, "Do you believe in winning time?" And he was like, "What do you mean? I don't get it." And I was like, "Do you think, or do you, like, how you are a very process-oriented person?" And he and I have spoken about that extensively before. So I was like, "Do you believe that a ground ball in the fourth quarter can have more value than a ground ball in the second quarter?" And he was like, "Oh, okay, thank you. I get it now." No, I do not. And, I asked him that question because when we spoke in the fall, he talked about how essentially playing without a scoreboard is like the standard that he aspires to. And, constantly competing for the next opportunity, the next micro play. A goal is a big play, a goal is a macro play, the micro play that can influence the outcome of the game. Don't care about your opponent and don't care about time and score. those are his attitudes. He's so like simplistic and dogmatic in his approach. And I really do appreciate it because, you know, when you think about team sports, like you win and lose by virtue of getting 50 people, 65 people. Like, I don't know how many support staff Hopkins has. They have probably like 53 guys on the roster and then like another 15 people that like actually touch the program on a day-to-day basis. So you have 68 people. Each of them have 0 to 100% of their energy and effort, right? So you essentially need to get, I don't even know how this would be. I guess it would be 68,000%, right? If you have 68,000 percentage points of effort going in the same direction, right? Anybody going in the opposite direction, that's like, that is worth like -2, right? Because you're subtracting the one, it's not going the way you want it to go, and it's going the other way, so it's pulling you back, right? So his job is to figure out how to get as significant a proportion of that 68,000 energy points going in the same direction. And I believe, and I think he believes, that simplicity is the likeliest way to yield that outcome. So you have to be direct and simple in the way in which you communicate the things that you think yield success, right? So like his offensive philosophy, and I know that I'm oversimplifying it, but not by a lot, is throw the ball to the open guy. He's like, there's always an open guy, just throw him the ball. And like, it sounds dumb because it's simple, but when you kind of have like 5 or 6 of those maxims and they make up the entirety of the approach to the game, then you start to understand like, what is the actual core thesis? What is the wisdom of this? And so like, you know, I visited him in the fall of 2021 and I visited him last fall. And in 2021, the theme was teaching how to compete, right? Basically, he didn't think that the team competed at the standard that he knew was required in order to be successful at the level they want to be successful at. And then in 22, it seemed as if he was, and that's this fall, right? Like this team's fall, like mm-hmm. So 5 months ago. He was okay with the level that they competed at. He was not okay with the attentiveness to detail, the attention to detail. And so that was the focus, right? And so it's weird because it's like, essentially like the evolution of what I'm talking about. When you become attentive to detail, you take like all the things about simplicity and you start to create the nuance and you start to make the, you know, the gray area. So like the one of the anecdotes that I used in the practice report that I wrote about was he actually took the time to explain that this is how we try to restart play. We don't run out on the field, look at the ref, and then start running. Because in that case, we're always going to get called back to the spot. We run out on the field, we stop, we hold up our stick with the ball in the stick. We say, I've got it, I've got it, I've got it. You wait for the whistle to blow, and then you start running. Basically, the reason that I was impressed by that is because, and it's not to say that no other coaches coach to the refs, but like there are 3 teams on the field. Most of the time you only conceive of the 2 teams on the field. But like, if you really want to start getting attentive to detail, you have to think about the officials because they have a significant effect on the game. And so I only share that to say that they are so good in the fourth quarter. It's kind of hard to believe that they don't actually care about winning time, right? Because if you're that good in the fourth quarter, why aren't you that good all game, right? If a ground ball is just as valuable in the second quarter as in the fourth quarter, why didn't you get it in the second quarter such that it wasn't a close game in the fourth and you had to outscore your opponent by 4 goals in order to win? Ultimately, to this point, hasn't mattered because they've been really good in winning time. And we saw it against Delaware. We saw it against Navy. Now we've seen it against Michigan. This was a really important game. This was a bellwether game in the way that it was going to influence confidence going forward. I'm not saying that Hopkins is going to be 5-0 in the Big Ten. I am saying that by virtue of beating Michigan, they think and believe that they can be 5-0 in the Big Ten. And this is where I want to make a clear, bright line. This is me speculating. This is not what Pete said to me because I didn't ask him that. And he certainly wouldn't tell me if I did. But I can tell you, based on my speculation of the Hopkins players that I know, that they always believe they can beat Maryland. They know that rivalry game, weird things happen. We saw it in 2021. So by beating Michigan and positioning themselves on a line where they could realistically be the second best team in the Big Ten, now all they have to do is win a game against a team that's probably better than Maryland and they're 5-0 in the Big Ten. Whereas for Michigan, if they had beaten Hopkins, like they would have kind of positioned themselves not on like that trajectory, but on like a really nice trajectory where they could have expected to probably go like 3-2 in the Big Ten. And now, I don't know, man. I would be very concerned about the creeping sense of doubt that would result from that loss, because they played well and they candidly like weren't close at the end. And it'll be trouble in terms of managing that moving forward and finding, you know, those one or two wins that are going to be necessary in order to making sure that they have at least a season, a Big Ten regular season that you wouldn't be disappointed by.
Yeah, no, that was a nice, concise way to put it. So,
Yeah, concise 6-minute explanation of a game that we were just going to speed right through. So keep it rolling.
just sped right through. Final point is I love, and I think coaches get too caught up in X's and O's and strategies when development and some simple overarching umbrella theories, and just like, I'd rather have an offense that's based around pass to the open guy than run 15 different plays, and you know, pretend like you're a freaking quarterback with three different types of options. So,
We're trying to get through games quickly, and you're going to say something like that and not expect me to react? Like, come on.
yeah. Well, then react and
All
tell
right. Well,
everybody
no,
why you're
shut
wrong.
up. No, it's not that you're wrong. It's that you're absolutely right. But my thing is that it's even more fundamental. I don't give a shit about throw the ball to the open guy. The only things that matter are like each other, potentially, if you possibly can, love each other. And believe that you can win. Like, if you have those two things, like each other and believe that you can win, you're going to win so many more games than you deserve to win. There are so many teams that lose because they don't like each other. And it's like, you know, it's 40 guys interconnected with 40 guys, right? And it only takes like 10 bad wire connections to like reduce the house to rubble. So, like each other and believe you can win. Believe that you deserve to want to try to win.
It's
I mean, it was one of the
interesting
things that
because I
drove
feel
me
like
crazy
on
about the
the
Notre Dame game.
spectrum, well, everybody in college, you know, generally speaking, you're going to find boys on the team, you're going to like it. I feel like, you know, in the contrast of from college to pros, very, very easy to see which pro teams don't like each other. Cough, cough. We always knew we were going to kick the shit out of the New York Lizards because of the egos in that locker room. And I feel like that's more representative than, oh, you know, we lost to Duke because Duke liked each other more than Notre Dame. So I agree with your thesis, and I sometimes think that that can almost get lost in the sauce of we need to spend and squeeze value out of every second of every day on the field. Some of the best times we had and the best lacrosse we ever played was on spring break because practice was cut short and we played three by with tennis balls, and that could have been arguably more impactful than a lot of other stuff. So,
No
anyways,
doubt. I
we do
mean,
need to move on.
there's
We
a
do
high
need to
school
move
that's
on.
No, you're gonna give me one more minute. So there's a high school that's right around the corner for me, and I walk past every day, and I just see two sets of line drills, like, you know, kids, they can't throw and catch, trying to throw the ball to each other, and I'm just like, everything about this is contrary to development. There's 18 kids, get 18 fiddlesticks, 25 softballs. Three by three goals, right? The entire expenditure is probably like $450. And just play three sets of 3-on-3 on a 3-by-goal in a basketball gym and just play it every day for like 3 weeks. And do like the hidden cardio, the touches, the composure, how much fun it is, like all of it. It is so compounding, it is so duplicative. Like, we have started doing it as a staff at Inside Lacrosse. I'm not speaking from like a lack of experience.
I'd slide high and late and take your head
It's
off a three
intoxicating.
by, but okay. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you're a clown. Dude, and this is why the softball thing is so important. In the first like minute and a half of playing, I got hit in the eye socket and the nuts. And if that had happened with a lacrosse ball, I would have been re dead and retired. But the fact that it was a softball, I was just like, all right. My ball, let's go. You know what I mean? Like,
Yeah.
whatever. We're way off the rails. Let's keep it rolling.
Way off the rails. Shout out to one of my good friends,
Well, you know
Roman
what's not off
Myers.
the rails? those PRTs in West Virginia.
Those little, yeah, the little West Virginia swipe your card, and then like in the Incredibles, evil villain in Syndrome's lair, you just kind of get picked up by a little. Final shout out to Roman Myers of Kingfisher Lacrosse in Iowa.
How many times do you think you would have reenacted the scene of the how many times do you think you would have reenacted the scene from Batman Begins when Ra's al Ghul and Batman are like going toward, spoiler alert, the train track that gets run out, and you're like you're like laying on your back as Batman, and like your best friend is like on top of you, and you're
I don't have to save you
off the train.
Yeah, it's like I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. I would have done that 100 times in a row, and maybe accidentally killed my friend just for a bit. And let me get this shout out in, and then we'll move on. No, Salone is the name of the town, and obviously, you know, Salone and Iowa have their geographic problems, and Roman put together this pretty cool plan to completely scrap the 10-on-10 rec program and go towards 5-on-5 with a tennis ball and a small goal, which increases the number of teams, increases the touches. It's a pretty cool program, and I'm working with him on it. So shout out. And if you're
there's
going to
be like two D1 lacrosse players coming out of Salone, Iowa in like 5 years.
Kingfisher lacrosse, tell you what. Cornell Penn. Okay, we got to the next game. Whew. Big game for Cornell. They won 18-12. And I feel like, you know, as far as surmise this game in one sentence, CJ Kirst is good. He had 7 goals. He had 7 goals in a variety of ways.
He played with a lot of tennis balls growing up, for sure.
Yeah, he definitely played 3-by. And the variety in which he was scoring was honestly what impressed me the most. No two highlights looked the same all over the field. Honestly, he put together an unstoppable performance. Penn went down 4-1. They fought back to tie it at 9-9. And then after 9-9, Cornell went on a 4-0 run. And in addition to CJ Kirst, I feel like it was crisp ball movement, just like we were talking about with Hopkins, a collective team effort that benefited him primarily, but don't sleep on any other players, nor the ability of the team to contribute to a stat line of 7 goals. On the Penn side of things, struggled to really get it back after they allowed Cornell to go on that 4-0 run in the third. Hanley had 3 goals on 4 shots, which I just feel like if you have a weapon like him, use him more and make him shoot. Just be like, hey, your minimum is 7 goals or 7 shots a game. That goal that he scored over Adler, who is a phenomenal defenseman and made it seem like he wasn't even there, his ability to shoot with pressure on him is a factor and a weapon that I don't think is emulated anywhere else in lacrosse. Arguably Brennan O'Neill, sometimes he gets shots off with someone draped all over him. But to have a physical presence and to only have 4 shots like that makes me think that there's something going on where he might be restricted in what he can kind of do and shoot. But Cornell Penn, 18-12, Terry.
Yeah, I mean, with the Hanley point in particular, you know, he's playing attack, which didn't work last year. I'm not really sure why it would work this year. So even though Dylan Gergar is hurt, I can understand it's not a desperate move, but it's a move made out of necessity. But they talked about it on the broadcast, and I think it's probably true. I don't think Sam is the type of player who wants to force it, right? And I think maybe that moving to attack put him in a position where he felt like he had to be more of a facilitator, or playing without Dylan made him feel like that. I don't know. I mean, this was a really tough game to forecast from the standpoint of both teams coming off a win, right? Like, obviously, Penn had beaten Princeton and righted the ship a little bit. Cornell coming off of a dominating win over Yale that allowed them to bounce back from their loss to Penn State. I just think Cornell's better, and I think Cornell is the best team in the Ivy League. I think there's a pretty significant gap. I think that they don't have any weaknesses. I think that they have a lot of different strengths. I think that it's impressive that they put up 18 goals without Michael Long after we saw what he provided last week with Yale coming off of that Penn State loss. So, you know, I mean, I don't know. I don't have a lot. And if they're going to win, like, what they win, 24 or 36 faceoffs, if they're going to win that much, that, you know, if they're going to be that successful facing off, like, they're going to be a very hard team to beat.
Honestly, it was a big week for semi-correct assumptions. Like, oh, Maryland, Penn State, Nailed it. Hopkins, Michigan. Nailed it. Cornell, Penn. Nailed it. So let's mix it up and say Princeton, Yale.
And yet I only went
didn't
three in my
see this
I
one.
I only went 3-2 in my picks. I don't know what that means. Oh, yeah, let's go.
Yeah, so this is honestly bananas. 23-10 is the final stat line. And this is a year that Princeton has been struggling. They had lost four in a row. They needed a win, and they needed a win in a big way. This is it. This is a good way to come back. Couple relevant notes. This is Yale's second loss by 10 or more in back-to-back games, which I don't know about you. That's not a good sign for me. And perhaps even something that stuck out to me as more relevant was Princeton was missing players. Alex Slusher on attack, Pace Billings on defense, and a short stick D Mitty, he doesn't have a name. And the faceoff guy, he doesn't have a name. They both were out. So for Princeton to generally be not at full capacity and still put up 23, I mean, just looking at the score box, I mean, you have to scroll down the page to see everybody that contributed to Princeton's stat line. And then I just go and check, and it's, you know, Brando's held scoreless, Yale only puts up 10 and still loses by 13. So be-do, red flag, mayday, mayday. Two 10-loss goals back-to-back for Yale.
Yeah, I mean, let me ask you, how hard should I press the panic button? Because I've been a Yale guy for like 10 years at this point in terms of like, you know, I just believe in the program. I believe in what they've done. I believe in their approach and their style of play. And I mean, this is cause for concern. They're playing too fast. They can't, their defense is not good enough to play the number of possessions that they are required to play. And their goaltender sees too many shots. They are not winning 70% of faceoffs, right? This was a 50-50 game. Offensively, they're struggling against zone, and they're doing well against man-to-man, but I don't think they're going to see much man-to-man because they're struggling against zone. So, what it comes down to, like, the reason I'm in the bag for Yale is because I feel like I've been along. And it's like in my like article history, like I have written about Andy Shea's progress and progression as a coach more specifically and acutely than I have any other coach. And so as a result, I feel like I am more attuned to the program's principles and its approach than I am pretty much any other program. And what's interesting is that like the schedule has always been really significant in Yale's trajectory. I wrote an article in 2011 about how important creating the Ivy League tournament was for Yale, because prior to the creation of the tournament, they always played Cornell and Princeton in their first two games of the regular season. And so at the time, you know, in like the 90s and 2000s, like those were the two best teams. So you would lose to both of them. You would start 0-2. And at that point, you just throw your hands up and be like, what's the difference? You know, we go 4-2 in the league. We're not winning, right? We're not getting the AQ. We're not going to the NCAA tournament. What's the difference? Why try, right? Whereas with the tournament, it's like, all right, you start 0-2. You go 4-2. You finish third in the league. You're on the road. You're the underdog in the semifinals. But if you're playing your best and you have the advantage of having lost the first game to both the number one and number two seeds, you're golden. That's the best case scenario. Part of me thinks that that is still available to them. Another part of me wonders what a post-national championship winning national runner-up in 2019 Yale program is like in that scenario. And so essentially, this is an opportunity for the players on the team to prove that they are as tough as all the guys who came before them that put the program in position to have that type of success, you know, despite all the, you know, kind of impediments that are well discussed, whether it be AI or admission spots or, you know, whatever. I guess the point is that, like, we are not post being able to take for granted Yale being good. We are in a position where they might not be good. And that was not something that a lot of people would have expected. You think about it, with TD in 2020, like they were the favorites, right? And then, who knows how good they would have been in 21. And then obviously in 22, they were really good and they lost in the quarterfinals. This doesn't look like a quarterfinal team to me in the last two games. They need to be better. They need to play better. Like, they cannot play at the level that they have played the last two games and expect to have the results that they want to have. So it's the onus is on them. Whereas for
Well, it's
Princeton,
unfortunate.
like,
Sorry, go ahead. Well, it's interesting because I think you hit it on the head with them playing too fast, and I think it's more difficult to get out of that mindset. I would almost rather lose, 9-3 as opposed to 23-10, because when you're playing fast, that's a very difficult thing to slow down. The game slows down in fall. The game slows down in preseason. The game doesn't, generally speaking, slow down a lot in the middle of the season. You don't learn how to not white knuckle your stick. You don't learn how to not panic halfway through the season. You learn that, through team discipline and through, repetitive drills and whatever, however your, Shea does it. It's a little late to learn to not panic and white knuckle and play fast. And that has me almost agreeing with you on if I'm hitting the panic button, I'm coming off the top turnbuckle and hitting it, because their brand of lacrosse is harder to break than, okay, we lost 9-3, we lost 10-5. We need to speed it
we just need
up.
to score a couple more goals and we're going to be fine.
Yeah, that's not this.
But on the other end of the spectrum, they did beat Villanova and they beat Denver, right? Penn State couldn't do that, right? So, like, how bad are they actually? It is a question that we need to ask. They're going to have good metrics. Their season is completely in front of them, but the manner in which they've lost these two games is cause for concern. And again, meanwhile for Princeton, like, your point about all these absences, they showed that last year too, right? Like, whether it was George Bond or Ben Finley or Pace Billings, like, it felt like they actually played better when they had guys out because everybody else was called to step up, right? And they just responded very, very well. They've gone with Mike Giampicaro, say it.
Carbonara pasta. I love that guy. Gian
I love his name.
Ficarro. He's the man.
So they've gone with him in the goal. And aside from that, Colter Bagsy is playing his way into a Toronto conversation. He's playing his way into a first team All-American conversation. I was with Jim Mitchell, who's the offensive coordinator, in January, and I asked him. It wasn't specifically about Princeton. It was about everybody nationwide. I was like, who's a guy that wasn't in All-American consideration last year that you think could be a teamer this year? And that was his answer. And so far, it's proven to be true. Colter Maxey's having an incredible season.
Good for him. And rounding out the last game that we're going to talk about, it's Army Loyola. Speaking of low scoring games, Army wins this one 10-5. And this one's more interesting for me, not necessarily with how the game ensued, but generally how these two seasons have been approached. I mean, Army losing their first game versus UMass and then going on a tear, winning every game since then. They're now 7-1 with wins over, I mean, granted, Loyola and Rutgers. Those are two not small wins. And then you look at, conversely, Loyola, who started off hotter than almost any other team in the country with wins over Maryland and Hopkins, and now they've dropped games to Rutgers, Duke, and this past weekend, Army. Three very good teams, Rutgers, Duke, and Army. You can't blame them for losing. So, honestly, looking at the last week's poll, Loyola coming in at 9 and Army coming in at 13, it kind of feels like a swapping of stories with Loyola versus Army. I'd rather see Loyola kind of replace them as this. Well, they didn't beat Maryland and they didn't beat Rutgers, but they're a team that is going to be really scary to run into. And Loyola just having some of these games be, generally speaking, low scoring. They lose by putting up 5 goals. They've lost 10-6 to Rutgers. They lost 17-9 to Duke. Granted, that one's a little bit of an outlier, but they're not the run and gun. Threat. They're the slow it down. And I feel like if you're going up against a you know, kind of a brick wall of a team, Army's replaced Loyola as the most dangerous slow brick wall.
Yeah, so Loyola hasn't played well since their Johns Hopkins game. They have played poorly in their wins, including last week against Bucknell. They really relied on Matthew Minakis to bail them out. And conversely, Army just hasn't played good enough teams in order for them to get recognition for the performances that they were putting in. They didn't play particularly well in a 12-10 win over Lehigh. You know, we saw Georgetown beat Lehigh 17-15 this week, so take that for what it's worth. This was a game that was won by the Black Knight defense. You know, Loyola scored five goals, two or three of them were in transition, depending on how you define the limits of transition. So they scored either two or three goals in 6-on-6 solid defense. Knox Dent was playing his best game of the season when he had a three-save flourish that was, you know, rivaling Brian Ruppel in terms of how impressive it was, but then slipped behind the goal on the wet turf after. He's going to get evaluated. It's unclear exactly what injury he sustained, but he was replaced by Matt Chess, who came in and played just as well for the last third of the game. You know, Loyola hasn't done well in West Point historically. These two teams have played 14 times in 8 years. It's incredible how much they have played against each other. Loyola had a huge win in West Point in 2021 in the Patriot League semifinals that allowed them to continue their season and, you know, have that kind of miraculous run that they had in 2021. But aside from that, it's been a tough trip for them. So, you know, again, not to reinforce the theme of things happening the way that we expected them to happen, but this wasn't unforeseen. You know, the thing about Army, and I talked to Joe Alberici after the game, and I asked, like, are you nervous about or are you worried about handling success? And he was like, we are so different from who we have been the last 4 or 5 years because of graduating 18 seniors off of that 2022 team, that it almost doesn't, like, I don't want to say it doesn't matter. It's just that managing success is just as new as everything else. So, like, everything about this season was new, and that's just another thing that is new. So it's another thing that they'll manage in a similar way. He did say in the video that their social media accounts posted that he only has one dance move. So that'll be problematic if they continue to stack these big wins and he's got to diversify his portfolio. I wonder if a Dartmouth grad might be able to help him with that. I don't know who. There was a blog called Big Green Beats that did a collab with us, I think is the word the kids used to say, in like 2012, 13. Your heyday, if memory serves. You might have made an appearance on one or two of those playlists. Big Green Beats. Yeah. The notion of Dartmouth people being music oriented is not foreign to Inside Lacrosse's archives.
Yeah. I mean, I'm picturing a barbershop quartet, like, you know, I'm not going to trust them to put on, you know, the best playlist, but yeah, maybe it's not diversify the portfolio. Maybe it's developing a bag if it's not an Ivy League. I feel like, you know, that's a bag of dance moves. You know, hey, not everything has to be Wall Street on this program, even though we do end up going back to that pretty frequently. But listen, I'm always going to be rooting for Army. Sorry if that makes me a patriot and makes me a better person than you. But
support the
any
troops.
Other stories, takeaways from this historically long episode of the Tailgate?
What's your address?
He's showing the number 20. I will text you my address. I'm not going to say it and distribute it to the public. So,
coward.
Oh, my goodness. That just tickles me in such a way. Is there any tape of your speech?
I think so. I don't know. My mom asked me that, actually. So I'm going to try to track it down. If I do, we'll put it side by side with the onside kick. And we'll see which people like better.
I love that. We'll make a March Madness bracket of Nick and Terry content, and we're just going right to the championship. Onside kick versus Terry. And funny, it's me and your mom that, it's the people that love you most that ask for stuff like that. So I feel like as we wrap up this episode, thank you so much for having me spew nonsense. And Terry, big fan of your work. That video that you sent me of those little personal little trains, shoeless refs, I'm so glad you had the weekend you did. I feel like it only lights the fire even further to go out and do great work like you do. Big fan of your work. Miss you. Love you.
Love you more, Nick.
Almost heaven, West Virginia, West Virginia, West Virginia, West Virginia.